Our first panel today, my name is David Forte. I'm chair of the first panel. First panel today in our annual meeting on the United States and the World arena will feature great scholars delineating the historical and theoretical foundations of American foreign policy. Now, am I clear or too loud in the back? How's the microphone working? Okay, great. Our three speakers today are Joseph Richard Campbell, Forrest MacDonald, and James Stoner. Richard Campbell, who's now at Palm Beach Atlantic College, is a scholar whose work illuminates the force of ideological and religious vision in American politics through such men as Woodrow Wilson and Abraham Lincoln. He is a scholar of great renown and an expositor of American constitutionalism and has held a number of prestigious fellowships and written and spoken at important venues such as the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He is a ruling elder at the Fellowship Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Florida, and it's nice to know that there's a good Presbyterian at Palm Beach. Jim Stoner, as all of us know him so well, is one of the most thoughtful and original thinkers on the common law in generations. We have not had a commentator who understood the common law and its historic and dynamic attributes since I think Maitland. He not only knows the substance of the common law and what people like Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. did to the common law, but he has shown its striking influence on the American polity. He is at Louisiana State University, but don't hold that against him. Professor Forrest MacDonald is one of the greatest minds, scholars, and gentlemen of the last and of this century. He is the author of a score of books, dozens of articles, and over 100 book reviews. Professor MacDonald has made understanding our constitutional history a lifelong labor of love, literally a labor and literally of love. He has shown generations how personalities such as Washington, Jefferson, and Hamilton, and how ideas such as in his two seminal works on the founding of the Constitution, and how economics and institutions such as the American presidency and now his latest work on states' rights have shaped us as a people. Above all, he is a teacher, a friend to all, and a generous sharer of everything that God has given him and of all that he has attained. It falls to me to give a brief introductory contextual remark of the three papers, which will be respectively by Professor Gamble on the savior nation idea of America, on Professor MacDonald on the presidency in American foreign policy, and on Professor Stoner on United States sovereignty and world order. And in this context, we have to remember that there is national styles that help shape foreign policy. For example, back in the 1980s, I worked with our delegation at the United Nations, and the story is that once in the margins, which means on the corridors of the Economic and Social Council, a reporter approached the delegates of the Soviet Union, the United States, Israel, and Poland, and put to them this question. He said, "Excuse me, but what is your opinion of the meat shortage?" And the Polish delegate said, "I'm sorry, what do you mean, meat?" And the American said, "I'm sorry, what do you mean, shortage?" The Soviet delegate said, "What is this word, opinion?" And the Israeli said, "I'm sorry, what is, excuse me?" Well, let me put it is allowed to me to take a few minutes to put a context in that, and I shall do so briefly. Over the past few centuries, the world has been organized in a number of mechanisms by which conflict, both violent and non-violent, has been channeled. And scholars have listed these methods of organization in categories of five, and let me explain them to you. The first is empire. Empire is a sense of a unitary state, not necessarily totally authoritarian, but a unitary state containing and controlling disparate elements within it. Empires work. They may be uncomfortable, and they're constantly putting down rebellions, but they do work. We have examples of Rome, of Islam, the Middle Kingdom, Russia. The idea of empire is the idea of universality. The idea of universality from Rome affected the Middle Ages. And so the Holy Roman Empire was supposed to be a holy Roman Empire. It affected even after nations became sovereign after the Reformation and the Renaissance, where France, in particular Austria, I mean particularly France, but also Spain, I meant to say, sought to have an empire in the Roman universalist mode. A second method, which followed the Treaties of Westphalia and the Treaty of Utrecht, has been denominated the balance of power. And essentially that mechanism is one which says that legally speaking, and this was the great compromise in the Treaty of Westphalia, every sovereign has a right to rule within its own borders, and necessarily, logically, it must recognize the legitimacy of sovereigns to rule outside of its borders. It is both power accepting and power granting. That came after the religious wars, as I mentioned. To maintain order in a sovereign state system, they developed what was denominated, or later denominated, the balance of power, whose mechanism is of shifting alliances. You recall from your history of the 18th century how France, Spain, and England kept shifting chairs every 10 years or so. There is no loyalty to a set of alliances, but it shifts according to one's national interests. But in these shifting of alliances, although external empires, overseas empires, may rise and fall, there is never the device of destroying the sovereignty of another state. That is accepted. The third method by which international relations in its conflictual manner, both peaceful and non-peaceful, has been organized, has been called the concert of powers, which after Napoleon undermined the shifting balance of power and sought a new empire, the concert of powers in the Restoration in 1815 established a new method, mainly led by Britain, but nonetheless, the concert of powers is one where the major powers police the world. They operate by consensus. They decide whether Greece will be independent. They accede to Poland's lack of independence. And they essentially rule the world through this consensual mechanism. The fourth method by which the world is organized is bipolarity. Bipolarity often occurs, as in Napoleonic times, when one nation seeks an empire and the rest gather around to oppose it. It's rigid, usually results in war, not always, has a form of stability, but it's a fragile, breakable, and often cataclysmic type of stability. We saw it before World War I, when the concert of powers broke down into permanent alliances. Permanent alliances are the sign of bipolarity, usually. You had the Central Powers and the Allied Powers before World War II. And incidentally, when Chamberlain went to Munich from the Treaty of Locarno in 1928 until Munich 1936, although he was an appeaser, what he was seeking in granting the lack of independence of Czechoslovakia, a state land, to Hitler, he was seeking to induce him to return to a concert of powers by appeasing him. It failed because Hitler was interested in empire, and the world quickly moved into a wartime bipolarity. And of course, we saw that after World War II. The final method of maintaining order has been denominated collective security. Collective security is not a group of nations gathering together for their security, as in NATO. NATO was an alliance in pursuance of bipolarity. Collective security is, as Woodrow Wilson defined it, where a group of states, nations, groups, agree that should any one of them seek to disrupt the balance of interests among them, seek to be aggressive, they shall all gather against it. The Rio Treaty in the Western Hemisphere is explicitly a treaty of collective security. And incidentally, the League of Nations was not an instance of collective security, despite Woodrow Wilson's hand in it, because the Council of the League was the central power. The United Nations is not an instance of collective security because the Security Council was the center of power. Both of those were devices to establish a concert of powers where the major nations were to gather and police the world. Of course, both of those broke down, but that was their image. Now, last night, there was two effusions of smoke that I witnessed. One was a group of erudite Philadelphia cigar smokers down here in the main lobby. The other was on television, showing the tear gas rising out of the Quebec demonstrations against a possible Western Hemisphere World Trade Organization. What has happened in the last 10 years is that we have not had a new world order, but we've had a new world disorder. Because the United States, which takes the place of Britain in the 19th century, has had the power and the influence to format a mechanism by which the world's conflicts shall be resolved and channeled, and it has failed to do so. Now, these methods of organizing world order are not necessarily universal at any one time. They can be regional. You can have collective security in the Western Hemisphere. You can have a concert of powers among the European nations policing Serbia, for example. In Europe, you can have bipolarity in Asia. But the new universalism, the new empire, has been seen through the United Nations. An empire is not necessarily a nation-state empire. Through the Kyoto Accords, the Beijing Conference, and others, we see a universalism that is imposing its will, and through the World Trade Organization, on all sides. You see a new form of universalism, a new form of empire. I don't call it imperialism because that has negative terms, negative connotations. A new form of empire that is seeking its method of organizing the entire world political structure. And in response, the United States policy has been episodic, reactive, and has no sense of what mix of orders should be present for American interests to prosper. All right, that's one context. Now, very briefly, a second context, which is the ideological context in which America operates in these different forms of world order that have occurred over the last two centuries. And I shall be very brief and overstate this for the sake of brevity, so excuse my exaggeration. But I think an example of how America has ambivalently reacted to this is the situation, the conflict over Washington's neutrality proclamation during the British-French wars in the 1790s. I believe that ever since the founding of the United States, we have had an ambivalent notion of what we are as a people based on a differing view of what the anthropology of man is. Where Washington saw, at that time, Napoleon, of course, hadn't taken power, that this was a world of shifting alliances and that America's interests lay in being neutral in the midst of these shifting alliances, Jefferson saw the image of empire. It was an ideological empire. It was a Jacobin empire. It was an empire of human rights. It was not an empire of nation states, but he thought in universal terms and consequently related to France, where Washington, in practical shifting alliances terms, related economically and practically to Great Britain. And that emanates, that's an example, I think, of this ambivalence that we've had since our founding between what was at that time called the Anti-Federalists and the Federalists, which have continued to this day. There's been a view of human nature of one party where man is regarded as naturally virtuous or divinely instituted as virtuous. And this has led to the messianic view of the United States or isolationism. But it's two sides of the same coin. The other, more federalist view is that virtue is not inherent, either by God or by nature, but attained. Washington struggled to attain an image of virtue. John Marshall struggled to attain virtue within the judiciary. And that group of the idea of the United States relies on the rule of law, on engagement, on utilitarian pragmatism towards beneficial goals, on the useful role of religion in producing the attainment of virtue. Now, these ideas have shifted with political parties. They get mixed. The former, the anti-federalist, tends to be ironically statist, either local statism before the Civil War or progressive statism with Wilson and FDR after, in the 20th century. And it's these two conflicting images of what our polity is based on what the nature of the human person is that I think waffles our foreign policy from one extreme to the other. Now, within these contexts, we are now going to hear some elucidations. The first is on the Christ nation or messianic, or I like to call it the messy way of American foreign policy, by Richard Gamble.